The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Hold it right there! Kay, you're going on report, asshole. Bringing a goddamn hooker on a delivery run?
And so it begins.
No, this is how it all ends.
Just in case anything went wrong.
Which it obviously did.
Sadly, yes. Almost immediately after launching, the missiles went wildly off course and hit Paris and Beijing. One landed in the Pacific Ocean.
Where was that again? Were the birds hot?
Edward. May I call you Ed? Alas, I truly dislike bloodshed. And you can still leave here alive? We know the man you are climbing with is an escaped convict. We only want him, not you, Ed. Not you. Stop protecting your friend. Tell us where he is, and you go free.
You got the wrong guy. Don't have a climbing partner. Work alone. I'm not the guy you want.
See? All you have to do is ask correctly, and civilians will tell you anything you need to know.
No, wait. I lied. I have a climbing partner.
No, you don't.
This is now a thermonuclear device, boosted by a tritium injector. The fireball alone will be 10 blocks wide, and the blast will spread over 100 miles.
Praise be to Allah.
Red alert. There's a super stallion on a parade ground getting ready to leave. Cargo must be Calvano.
Can't see it. There's too much flame and smoke.
We're on the way. Stay loose and... Got 'em, Lines. Their base is at Black Rock Mesa in McHenry County, about 50 miles deep in the heart of the Badlands.
In a world rife with human suffering, a nuclear madman pursues his twisted dream of salvation. Stonyman 92, Capital Offensive.
Giants, including the biggest and ugliest of those big and ugly brutes I have ever seen. Meyer Deck, he's called. And even the Powrys, even Koskosio Begulin himself, gives him great respect. His armor is special, I fear, perhaps even magical, for it seems almost to have an inner fire.
Feel me! This is only one human! One puny human! 100 pieces of king's gold, and 10 prisoners to the one that brings me the head of Nightbird!
You believe this to be a game? Tell me where she is!
You're a wretch! You're calling yourselves men of God, but no good God would approve of your works. You took from me, you thieving wretch, and for that I'll see you pay!
Who's there?
You knew we would come for you.
Your Markwart is an evil man. I call on you now, in the name of the solemn vow of our order, piety, dignity, poverty, to turn against this evil course, to find again the light.
Don't miss Demon Wars Saga Book 2, The Demon Spirit Part 2. Available now from Graphic Audio. And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terence Aselford. With performances by Mort Shelby, Thomas Penny, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, Eric Messner, Sonny Lasky, James Konacek, Elizabeth Jernigan, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael John Casey, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Kate Foster, Ren Casey, Jeff Baker, David Elias, Lily Beacon, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Lily David, Amanda Thickpenny, and Dylan Lynch. Survivalist, Midwake, Part 2.
Sonar's picking up Soviet scout subs, Captain. But, sir, it looks as though their own island-class submarines are pursuing them.
Commander Sebastian's dark hands were splayed over the illuminated plotting board dominating the control station.
Sonar, talk to me.
Sir, I've got 4 Soviet scout subs proceeding at flank speed, but rather erratically. I have 3 island-class... correction, 4 island-class submarines in the classic Soviet pursuit formation. None of the island-class submarines is dragging a sonar array.
Very good, Lieutenant Kelly. Keep on it.
Commander Jason Darkwood, captain of the USS Ronald Reagan, swung his chair left.
Communications, what are you getting, Lieutenant?
I'm starting to get low-frequency transmissions on the Soviet distress band, Captain, but the signal is too weak, sir. I can't make anything out of it.
Darkwood turned his chair toward the warfare station.
Lieutenant Walensky, what's the status on the torpedo tubes?
Forward torpedo status, numbers 1 and 4 empty, numbers 2 and 3 loaded with high explosive independent sensing, Captain. 1 and 4 can be loaded. Aft torpedo status, numbers 1 through 4 loaded with HEIS, Captain.
Very well, Lieutenant. Order forward torpedo tubes 1 and 4 loaded with HEIS as well.
Aye, Captain.
He looked back to Sebastian.
Commander, anything further?
Negative, Captain. Still monitoring.
Order the ship to battle stations, Mr. Sebastian.
Aye, Captain. Ordering the ship to battle stations.
Sebastian pulled down the intership communications microphone.
Now hear this. Battle stations. Say again, battle stations. This is not a drill.
The captain got out of his chair and moved aft between the sonar and computer stations. Seaman First Class Tagachi stood at the periscope station.
Attack periscope.
Seaman Morris Tagachi activated the control panel. He was already at the attack periscope, folding down its handles as the tube rose. At this depth, it was hard for Darkwood to see anything, even with vision intensification and computer enhancement. But just off the starboard bow, he thought he could make out one of the great hulking shapes of the Soviet monsters. He snapped the handles back to closed.
Captain, I have their position. Precisely 23 degrees off our starboard bow, moving north by northeast at 41 knots.
Thank you, Mr. Sebastian. What does sonar tell me about their engines?
90%, Captain. Not at maximum.
Very well.
Sebastian looked up at him from the control deck. Jason Darkwood stood beside his chair at the con.
Help.
Aye, Captain.
Lieutenant Lorene Bowman was ready for Darkwood's command.
Plot and intercept course with those scout subs. After you've brought her about, go to all ahead full, Lieutenant.
Aye, Captain.
Engineering?
Aye, Captain.
Saul, notify me immediately if the starboard reactor starts acting up again and put everything into the port reactor. We're going to need speed with that wolf pack out there.
Aye, Captain.
The captain took the 3 steps down onto the control and navigation level, not bothering to study Sebastian's console. He stared forward at the composite video screen dominating the forward bulkhead. He could make them out almost as clearly as through the attack periscope, which wasn't clear at all. He turned and looked back at Sebastian.
What do you think, Sebastian?
I don't have the data to support anything beyond sheer supposition, Captain.
Give me some sheer supposition, then.
Sebastian's powerful shoulders shrugged and the corners of his mouth turned down.
Sheer supposition, Jason. All right. I'd say somebody, people unknown, have stolen several of the scout subs and are being pursued. At this juncture, that's all I can offer.
The captain nodded.
Sonar?
Aye, Captain.
Have Soviet vessels fired torpedoes yet?
Negative, Captain.
Notify me immediately if they fire.
Aye, Captain.
Jason Darkwood stared at the composite video screen, wishing that at least once in a while it would provide the impetus for some brilliant flash of insight. It wasn't cooperating. He stepped around Sebastian's console and pulled down the microphone out of the overhead.
Now hear this? Now hear this. This is the captain speaking. In answer to your unspoken questions, the answer is no, I don't know what's going on. We have several Soviet scout subs which are apparently being pursued by island-class submarines, which we cannot outgun, but which we can outrun and definitely outmaneuver. I will keep you informed. Captain, out.
He secured the microphone, turned toward the con, ascended the three steps, then sunk into his seat. For a few absent-minded seconds, he drummed his fingertips on the right armrest.
Helm.
Aye, Captain.
How are we coming on the intercept course?
We should be immediately astern of the four scout ships in 3 minutes and 45 seconds, Captain Darkwood, at the present course and speed.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
Darkwood stared ahead at the composite video screen. All the hull-mounted cameras, fore and aft, above and below, were computer-controlled to produce a solid image.
Communications, bring up aft projection on the screen.
Aye, Captain. You have aft projection.
The picture changed. He saw nothing else suspicious within visual range. The intercept course would put them in the line of fire of the lead elements of the Soviet island-class wolf pack in a little less than 2 minutes.
Communications, forward visual display.
Forward display now, Captain.
Forward display showed the four Soviet monsters clearly now, closing along their starboard side with the scout subs.
Helm.
Aye, sir.
On my signal, be prepared to bring us hard about to port and cut speed to half-flank speed.
Aye, sir.
Saul.
Aye, sir.
Have your people in engineering deliver a pig of lubricant to the aft torpedo room on the double. Sealed just tightly enough, she'll burst when she hits the water.
Aye, Captain.
Lieutenant Walensky.
Aye, Captain.
Pull the HEIS out of aft torpedo tube 4 and make preparations to load the pig of motor oil.
Aye, Captain.
Sebastian, work with Lieutenant Bowman on a cripple course. Get Mr. Rodriguez on it.
Aye, Captain. Lieutenant Rodriguez, have computer plot a damaged vessel course. I assume the portside reactor, Captain?
Yes. Portside reactor it is, Sebastian. You get my drift.
Darkwood hit the comm switch on the right arm of his chair.
Sickbay.
Sickbay, Dr. Barrow.
Margaret, this is Jason. If what we're doing works, we'll be taking those scout subs into our own scout sub bay. Maybe some injured personnel.
I'll be ready, Jason.
Right.
He shut off, then back on to break the connection.
Security.
Security. Lieutenant Stanhope.
Darkwood.
Yes, sir.
I want full security moving to the scout sub bay on the double. Be prepared for anything, since I have no idea what to be prepared for.
Yes, sir.
Jason Darkwood clicked off.
Sonar, any word on torpedoes yet?
Nothing happening, sir. They have us on their sonar, that's all.
Keep me informed.
He rotated his chair forward, and his eyes met Sebastian's.
Yes, Commander?
It was the Battle of Miner's Reef, wasn't it? Your father?
Yes, my father against Admiral Suvorov. But that was 40 years ago, and I doubt seriously that any of our friends out there are heavy into American history. At least, let's hope not. Hmm?
Then you are planning your father's maneuver.
Yeah, the ruptured duck was what he liked to call it, Mr. Sebastian.
Darkwood checked the timepiece in his chair console. 30 seconds until intercept.
Helm, be ready for that maneuver.
Aye, Captain.
Lieutenant Walensky, ready with that oil pig and aft torpedo tube 4?
Aye, Captain, ready to fire on your command.
I'll be giving that command shortly.
He looked forward.
Helm, do it now.
Aye, Captain. Hard to port and reducing to half flank speed. Cutting in Mr. Sebastian's computer program.
Very well. Communications?
Aye, Captain.
Those signals any clearer?
They're being jammed, sir, but what I'm making out sounds like it might be English.
After all this trouble, I certainly hope so. Broadcast this message to the Soviet scout subs. United States attack submarine Reagan calling scout subs. We were attempting to come to your aid, but must break off. Godspeed. Sign it Jason Darkwood, Commander, Captain of the Reagan. And send it quick. Keep repeating it until I say otherwise.
Aye, Captain.
He looked at Sebastian.
Think we could make one of the island classers come after us? Maybe two?
Then you have embellished your father's famous maneuver.
About to embellish, actually.
We could fire at one of them, but unless we move out quickly, we'll be...
Darkwood let himself smile.
Engineering. While keeping revolutions at current speed, gradually bring offline the starboard reactor. Then at my signal, bring both reactors to maximum and kick into maximum drive on the screws.
Saul Hartnett pushed both hands back through his thick black hair.
You want us to take off like a bat out of hell, don't you, Captain?
More or less.
He looked away.
Helm, hold present course, but on my signal, take us straight through the middle of the concentration of enemy vessels. You won't have time for computer. Make sure we get it right, Lorene, or I'll have the people that own this boat really pissed with my estate.
Aye, Captain.
If my calculations are correct, we will reach a speed of 45 knots in 17.9 seconds. May I advise collision quarters?
Good idea. Alert all hands.
Alerting all hands to collision quarters, Captain.
Sebastian pulled down his microphone.
Now hear this. Now hear this. Collision quarters. All hands, collision quarters.
Darkwood cranked his chair to his right and back, looking over Julie Kelly's shoulder at the sonar display. Sonic impulses were translated into computer imaging and made visual on the various screens before her. He could see the Soviet wolf pack tightening up on the scout subs, apparently little interested in the Reagan.
Sonar, be ready with some crippled ship noises.
Aye, Captain.
Jason Darkwood turned his chair around to face forward, his eyes riveted to the composite video screen and the forward bulkhead of the command deck.
Helm, implement the maneuver.
Implementing maneuver, Captain.
Engineering, start taking that starboard reactor offline.
Starboard reactor coming offline.
Warfare, you have the order to fire that pig.
Aye, Captain. Firing pig through aft tube 4.
Lieutenant Stanhope to the bridge. Please notify the captain that security is in place in the scout sub-bay.
Sebastian glanced up at Darkwood, and Darkwood nodded, his eyes intent on the video display.
The captain has the word, Mr. Stanhope.
They're following us.
Two of the Soviet Island-class submarines had broken off from the wolf pack to outflank the Reagan.
Helm, tell me when we're right behind them.
Aye, Captain.
Lieutenant Walensky, have cluster charges ready to fire off port and starboard sides amidships on my command.
Preparing cluster charges to fire off port and starboard sides amidships on your command, Captain.
Sonar, give them our noise.
Making noise now, Captain.
Captain, we are exactly equidistant to all four Soviet Island-class.
Hold her steady, Lieutenant. Louise, ready with those cluster charges?
Aye, Captain. Cluster charges are ready.
Fire cluster charges now.
Aye, sir.
Engineering, give me everything you've got now.
Aye, aye, Captain.
Navigator, complete the maneuver.
Aye, aye, sir.
The Reagan accelerated, slapping Darkwood back by the G-force as if it were some invisible hand. The display on the composite video screen turned a gray blur for an instant while the cameras adjusted focus.
Communication. Belay that fake message and signal the scout subs to draw out of our immediate vicinity and be ready to dock with us and abandon ship.
Aye, Captain.
Mr. Sebastian, plot a firing pattern based on our present trajectory using aft torpedo tubes 1, 2, and 3. Warfare, what's the status on those cluster charges?
82% impact ratio on starboard package, 81% impact on port side package.
Good. Engineering, how are we holding out? Anything melt yet?
Pretty good, Captain.
Margaret Barrow's voice came over the comm line.
Jason, what are you doing up there?
Taking a ride, Margaret. How's sickbay?
I almost had a patient throw up all over me.
Darkwood didn't know what to say to that. He clicked the comm line to kill it. He turned to Hartnett.
Engineering, complete that report.
Both reactors online, Captain. Starboard reactor getting a little hot, but nothing even near critical.
Helm, cut to full flank speed and bring us hard about to port. Don't bother responding.
He turned his chair left.
Warfare, aft torpedo tubes ready?
We have Mr. Sebastian's program, sir. Ready on your command.
Excellent. Helm, flank speed, right through the middle of them again.
Aye, Captain. Going to full overdrive.
Warfare, I want forward torpedo tubes 1 through 4 ready to fire on my signal. You'll have it in...
He glanced at the video screen and at the digital time display on his console.
10 seconds. After firing forward torpedoes, give me another set of cluster charges just like before. And on my signal, fire aft torpedoes with Sebastian's program.
He didn't wait for an answer.
Helm, on my firing command, that is your command for every ounce of speed we've got.
Aye.
Warfare, fire forward torpedoes now.
Firing forward torpedoes, Captain.
Now the cluster charges.
The G-force came again, this time harder than before.
Firing cluster charges, Captain.
Sonar, watch your ears.
Thank you, Captain.
Let's have Sebastian's aft torpedo program now.
Aft torpedo program implementing, Captain.
Helm, get us the hell out of here before the concussion ruptures us.
Aye, Captain. Employing evasive maneuvers.
The Soviet Island-class submarines were taking cluster charge hits and simultaneously beginning their own evasive action patterns.
Sonar, back online?
Aye, sir.
Tell me how our friends are doing.
Island-class submarines off our stern have sustained what sounds like at least one direct hit. Torpedo. I think two of them are in trouble, sir.
Communications Officer Andrew Mott pulled his headphones tighter.
Captain?
What is it, communications?
Two of the island-class submarines have just collided, sir, according to their transmission.
Darkwood leaned forward in his seat.
Mr. Mott, please convey our compliments and condolences to the commanders of the island-class submarines so afflicted.
Aye, Captain.
Warfare, what have we got?
Cluster charges off starboard, 86% with wide dispersion. Cluster charge package off port side, 84% with wide dispersion as well. Forward torpedoes, 1 and 2 still traveling. Numbers 3 and 4 have impacted. Computer currently assessing damage to enemy vessels. Aft torpedo 3 is off my instruments and may be down. 1 and 2 have impacted. Computer assessing damages, Captain.
Excellent.
He turned forward.
Helm, reduce to full flank speed and maneuver to evade enemy response.
Sir, a wire guide torpedo of theirs was fired. The only one so far. Coming after us at 40 knots on a trajectory to impact us amidships on the port side in 10 seconds and counting.
Helm, belay that previous order. Everything we've got and fast. Engineering, help her out. Sebastian, plot the duration time on that wire guide.
Plotting now, Captain.
Darkwood looked at the video screen. The pillars of woe were straight ahead, chimneys of undersea rock extending several hundred feet toward the surface, scattered at irregular intervals for several nautical miles square. Beyond them, a deep trench. Within the trench, a volcanic vent, part of the system that provided geothermal power to the Russian domes.
Lorene, hold as much speed as you can and take her through the pillars on my commands.
Captain Darkwood charged forward to the video screen.
Sebastian, advise the crew to maintain collision quarters.
Advising the crew to maintain collision quarters, Captain.
Now hear this? Now hear this. All hands maintain collision quarters. All hands maintain collision quarters.
So now, how close is that wire guide?
12 seconds and staying right on us, sir.
Give me word if the gap gets below 10.
Aye, Captain.
Darkwood grasped the forward rail with both fists, his eyes intent on the video screen.
Lorene, we're doing it.
Aye, Captain.
10 degrees right rudder.
A chimney was dead ahead, but the gap between it and the one off their bow was tight.
Back 1/3, 5 degrees left rudder. Maintain reduced speed. 5 degrees right rudder, ahead to flank speed.
His head was beginning to ache.
Right rudder, 10 degrees. Back 1/3. Left rudder, 5 degrees. Shoot me some air, up 50 feet.
The pillars of woe were tight here, and the only way through was to come up, over, and dive.
10 degrees on the bow planes. Level bow planes and 10 degrees right rudder. All ahead, full flank speed now.
The Reagan dipped inside the heart of the Pillars of Woe. Frightened undersea creatures hastened out of its way.
Sonar, tell me about the wire guide.
Still 12 seconds out, Captain.
Helm, back 1/3 rudder amidships. Sonar, give me a count.
12 seconds to impact, Captain. 11. 10. 9. Only 7, sir. 6. 5, sir. 4.
Helm, 20 degrees on the bow planes, 10 degrees right rudder. All ahead, full.
The Reagan lurched violently, angling upward. Darkwood held tight to the railing, legs braced against the deck as he eyed the pillars of woe.
All back, rudder amidships.
He felt the shudder. The chimney of stone off the port bow trembled and tumbled.
Sonar, tell me what's happening.
Wire guide detonated 50 yards off the port bow, sir.
Engineering, damage report.
Aye, Captain. Checking for damage.
Hartnett began checking readouts from the ship's departments. Darkwood leaned against the railing.
Sonar, any new friends to report?
Negative, sir.
Lieutenant Bowman, you've got the helm. Sebastian, keep an eye out for the island classes and get a rendezvous set with the scout subs. I'll be in the scout sub bay. You have the con.
Very well, Captain.
Darkwood headed aft, past Sebastian's station, up the three low steps and past his chair, between the sonar and computer consoles. Morris Tagachi remained at his post by the periscope controls. Darkwood shot the young man a grin as he stepped into the shaft for the utilitarian but efficient vertical conveyor, his feet positioned on the step, his left hand on the strap. He moved down.
Mr. Sebastian, all damage reports are negative, sir.
On the next level below, Darkwood stepped out, moved around the conveyor shaft, and headed aft toward sickbay. Sebastian would signal for permission to step down from collision quarters as soon as they were out of the Pillars of Woe. But battle stations would be maintained until whoever was aboard the scout subs came aboard. The scout subs were released well away from the Reagan and destroyed, and the Reagan was well away from the Russian domes. Sickbay was just ahead. He turned from the companionway and entered the reception area.
Captain Darkwood, sir?
As you were.
He continued through to Margaret's surgery, not having seen her through the windows in the sickbay door. She was sitting at her desk.
Is all of this over with, Jason?
Well, more or less.
You ready to take on your passengers?
Whoever they are. I thought you might want to come along.
Lieutenant Commander Margaret Barrow stood up from her desk and smiled at him.
Huh, some cheap shot date.
Ooh, stick with me afterward and I'll buy you a cup of coffee in the officer's mess.
Huh, yuck.
She passed through the still open surgery door and into the reception area. He followed her and they made their way back along the companionway toward the vertical conveyor.
Who do you think these guys are?
In the scout subs? If we're lucky, escaped prisoners, but, well, that's pretty much stretching it. They do speak English. Could all be some kind of setup. I've got security down there.
What would I need security for when I'm with you?
Can't argue with logic like that.
He followed her onto the conveyor. He looked down at her as they were carried along. Her hair had always been one of her best features, dark brown with lighter highlights when the light was just right. Just a little past the nape of her neck and not really within regs, but she was a doctor, and doctors were notorious about regs. He remembered the scent of her hair, even though it had been a very long time. Like roses. She stepped off the conveyor and he followed after her.
Bridge to Captain. Bridge to Captain.
Just a second, Margaret.
He depressed the push-to-talk switch on the squawk box.
This is the Captain.
Captain Darkwood. Request permission to step down from collision quarters. We have cleared the Pillars of Woe.
Permission granted. Maintain battle stations.
Of course, Captain.
I'm just about to reach Scout Sub Bay, Sebastian. Keep me informed as necessary. Darkwood out.
He walked on. Margaret stood waiting for him a little further along the companionway, near the entrance to the reactor complex. He hurried past it with her, and where the companionway reached a T-intersection, he took the right passageway, leading toward the Scout Sub Bays.
So, how about dinner when we get back to Midwake? I promise to be good.
You always promise to be good, but you never are.
Yeah, I know. But you wouldn't want me to change after all these years.
Just dinner?
She smiled. The companionway lights danced in the green of her eyes.
Well, drink or two, maybe? How about it?
Jason Darkwood. Looking for platonic companionship?
Plato has nothing to do with it. And if companionship is all that's available to me at the moment...
Oh, that's just the trouble, Jason. You'd want more, and so would I.
He touched her right elbow with his left hand.
Well, maybe I'm saying we can try again.
Maybe I know you're saying that, Jace. Dinner. But just that for now.
Dinner. Agreed.
They reached the scout sub bays. The bays reminded him of a vast, seatless auditorium. Located on the starboard side of the Reagan, they occupied the entire central section of the lower level, the clearance above, some 30 feet. The Reagan scout-class vessels sat secured on rails to be brought into position for transfer through one of the two massive airlocks into the sea. But all three of the scout subs were locked down, and the activity by the airlocks was that of the Marine Corps security detail under the command of Lieutenant Tom Stanhope. When Sam Aldridge went MIA, Darkwood requested Stanhope, Aldridge's second-in-command for the Marine unit, be temporarily placed in charge. Darkwood realized it was simply his reluctance to accept the finality of death. Jason Darkwood and Sam Aldridge attended the Naval Academy together and remained friends ever since. When Darkwood earned command of the Reagan, and with it the prerogative of staffing it with his pick of available officers, the two he picked were Sebastian and Aldridge. Some called it a curious choice. One even asked if he didn't like people of his own race, Sebastian and Aldridge both being black. Darkwood considered it fortuitous that the person who asked the question was male, approximately his own size, approximately his own age, and of neither greater nor lesser rank. All those factors taken into consideration, he punched the man in the mouth. But it was a curious choice. Sebastian, though in superb physical condition and an accomplished man of violence when necessary, abhorred violence and was best described as cerebral, although someone 6'6" and slightly over 220 pounds was rarely considered that. Aldridge was, had been, about Darkwood's own height, a little over 6 feet. And though Aldridge was a gifted scholar, he hardly gave that image. He looked and acted the consummate man of action. Within Midwake's closely knit black community, it was said that Aldridge and Sebastian were distant cousins, something both men vehemently denied. In Midwake, it was almost an oddity not to be related to half the people you knew or worked with. Saul Hartnett's mother was Darkwood's aunt, and sonar specialist Julie Kelly was the daughter of Hartnett's father's brother. Darkwood wondered if that made him and Julie Kelly cousins of some kind. He and Margaret Barrow were not related at all. They sat up until 3 in the morning once, confirming that by comparing genealogies, another common pastime at Midwake. As they neared the airlocks now, he turned to Margaret.
Why don't you take the stairs to the observation platform and wait there, just in case?
I'm a naval officer and I'm a doctor, so in both cases, I belong right here.
She smiled at him.
True. In fact, you're my chief medical officer. Which is why, if things get hairy here, I'd rather you were out of harm's way so you can direct your staff as they tend to our medical needs. We'll get you down here as soon as the area is secured and we know what we're dealing with, Commander.
Aye, aye, Captain.
She broke off from him and ran toward the stairs leading up to the platform. Darkwood watched her over his shoulder for a moment, then continued on.
Attention!
As you were, gentlemen.
Captain, the scout sub bays are secure.
Somehow I knew they would be, Tom. Loan me your communicator.
Here you go, sir.
Stanhope took the radio from his belt pouch and handed it to him. Darkwood depressed the push-to-talk button.
Bridge, this is the captain. Sebastian, anything new on the scout subs?
We have not been able to get a clean transmission from the scout subs, Captain. For that reason, I would advise caution, lest it prove to be some Russian trick. If they understood our transmissions and allowed our remote interlock, docking should begin in less than a minute. I was about to inform you.
Consider me informed. Once we get whoever it is aboard, I'll have Stanhope notify you as soon as the Russian vessels are clear of our docks, and Lieutenant Walensky can practice her marksmanship.
I will advise Lieutenant Walensky, Captain.
Very well. Captain out.
Darkwood handed back the radio.
Deploy your men, Lieutenant. I'll observe.
Very good, sir. Marines, to your posts!
Darkwood wanted to say something, but didn't. He drew back instead to wait a respectable distance from the Marines and the airlocks. A quick glance at Margaret on the observation platform got him what looked like an angry, at least a little, look back, and he wondered if dinner was still on. When he was first awarded command of the Reagan, Jason Darkwood personally involved himself in everything. He came to learn that wasn't the right way. Taking virtually direct command of the helm when they successfully eluded the wire guide torpedo was necessary. He knew the Pillars of Woe better than anyone on board, but after a few awkward experiences, he learned that the function of command truly was the delegation of authority. Ever since he learned that lesson, life for everyone aboard the Reagan grew easier, most particularly for himself. It was this understanding of command that led him to pass by the arms locker without grabbing a weapon. That was what the Marines were for.
Docking in airlock 1 accomplished. Equalizing pressure now.
Rumor at the Academy was that the computer voice was synthesized from a 500-year-old film. Whatever its origin, the English the machine spoke was lovely. Darkwood watched and waited. Stanhope held his pistol ready for action. His Marines carried their assault rifles battle-ready. Darkwood did not remind them that a serious firefight could put holes in the Reagan's hull, that the sea would then rush in, and the hull, its integrity gone, would rupture and they would all die. Hopefully Stanhope and his people remembered. Darkwood learned that as well. It was wise to assume everybody might be an idiot, but not that they actually were. On the other hand, some unpleasant surprises were permanent.
Docking in airlock 2 accomplished. Equalizing pressure now.
The interior door of airlock 1 started fanning open. Darkwood realized he was balling his fists and getting ready for something, though he wasn't sure what. He locked his hands behind him instead, like some sort of admiral.
Captain, airlock 1 is opening, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Stanhope.
Darkwood wanted to add that he was neither blind nor deaf, but didn't. The airlock door opened. Through a mist of seawater stepped Sam Aldridge, 30 pounds lighter, dressed in rags and visibly wounded. Tears filled Jason Darkwood's eyes as he ran across the deck.
my God, Sam!
Oh, this isn't command behavior, but the hell with it.
Sam, holy... Well, just look at you.
I know, Captain. I look like shit.
Aldridge embraced him. Then it dawned on them both that two grown men, officers, hugging each other and crying, looked, well, dumb. They stepped away from one another. Aldridge saluted.
Permission to come aboard, sir.
Oh, hell, I suppose so.
Aldridge grinned, then turned toward Tom Stanhope.
You don't have these Marines snapped to when a superior officer comes aboard?
Tan Hutt!
Stanhope saluted. Aldridge saluted, then clasped Stanhope's right hand.
Tom, you have changed a bit.
Aldridge looked at Darkwood.
Sir, I have several wounded personnel aboard, and one of them, a civilian, is critical.
Darkwood nodded, turning toward the observation platform. Margaret was already on her way. Darkwood shrugged mentally. It was hard to get someone to remember you were her captain when you had been her lover. He looked at Sam Aldridge.
A civilian?
Name is John Rourke, Captain. And that he isn't dead already is some kind of miracle. Here.
Aldridge hustled back toward the airlock. Two men and a woman. One of the men, a Marine, and the other a Chinese? Were carrying, on a makeshift litter, a man of roughly his own size and build. The man wore a ripped and much bloodied Soviet Marine Spetsnaz sergeant's uniform. Some sort of double shoulder holster with pistols hanging in it and a knife as long as a short sword.
A civilian?
He's a doctor, and he's an American. He's not from Midwake, and he's about the bravest man I ever met, Jason.
As Darkwood neared the stricken man, Margaret Barrow ran past him. Closer to the man, Darkwood could see some of the man's wounds were bandaged. Clumsily, it appeared.
Jason, I need this man in sickbay as fast as possible, and I need people to meet me down here with...
Stanhope, see to it that Dr. Barrow gets everything she needs down here on the double. Get some of your men under Dr. Barrow's direction to assist with the other wounded. Sam, point out the most serious. And get those scout subs away from here fast so we can blow them up and get ourselves away from here.
He looked at Margaret.
Can facilities aboard the Reagan meet your medical needs?
Negative on that. Not with this man. If I started telling you everything that's wrong with him just by looking at him, he'd be dead by the time I finished.
Right.
Darkwood sprinted across the deck toward the squawk box, Stanhope's belt radio already in use up to sickbay. He reached the squawk box on the far bulkhead and hit the push-to-talk button.
Bridge, this is the captain. Sebastian, be ready to implement the most expeditious course possible to Midway. There are injuries down here requiring medical facilities beyond our onboard capabilities. As soon as the Soviet scout subs are away and destroyed, implement it at once.
I will proceed to carry out your orders, Captain.
Sebastian, Sam is alive. He's back.
Please convey my felicitations to Captain Aldridge, and that I look forward to congratulating him personally on his escape.
I certainly will. Captain out.
Darkwood leaned against the bulkhead for a minute. A civilian American doctor named Rourke, armed to the teeth. A hero. But where was he from? Margaret Barrow was administering a shot to him while one of her nursing staff was getting an IV going. His stretcher was in motion toward sickbay. From the man's condition, there might not be much time to get the answers. And somewhere at the back of his mind, it all sounded familiar. A doctor of medicine named John Rourke, who was a hero's hero. Something from the early history of Midwake. He hit the squawk box again.
Computer, this is the captain.
Voice print identity processing. Confirmed. Proceed, Captain Darkwood.
Identify name John Rourke, doctor of medicine. Involved in some heroic action in the early history of Midwake.
Processing.
Darkwood waited.
Rourke, John Thomas. Biographical extract. Rourke, John Thomas. Doctor of medicine. Weapons expert. Survival expert. Former case officer, pre-war United States Central Intelligence Agency. Presumed deceased during period of atmospheric fires, which consumed Earth's surface and destroyed terrestrially-based life forms following massive ionization effect as a result of nuclear exchange during World War III. Exploits of John Thomas Rourke, chronicled by Commander Robert Gunderson, USN, after his vessel, the USS John Paul Jones, docked at Midway following commencement of World War III. Gunderson...
Darkwood knew the rest of the story. He studied it in history classes. He smiled at the thought as the stretcher with the critically injured, certainly dying man passed him. Of course, this couldn't be the real Rourke, just a similarity of names. What made Jason Darkwood smile was that he flunked a history test because he spelled Rourke with an A rather than a U. His past was coming back to haunt him.
Computer, physical description of Rourke, John Thomas.
Processing. Rourke, John Thomas. Physical description as follows. Exact quotation from Commander Gunderson's memoirs entitled A Warrior's Recollections. John Rourke stood well over 6 feet tall, lean, well-muscled. His forehead was high, but naturally so because his hair was thick, healthy, dark brown with a touch of gray when I knew him. He was soft-spoken, and I remember he seemed to move with the grace of a cat. Both his speech and his manner implied there was tremendous energy beneath the surface of this mine. As I later found out, there was indeed a tremendous energy coupled with immense, almost superhuman self-control. Rourke's hands were the hands of a pianist or a surgeon. I later learned he was accomplished in both disciplines, though I only had the opportunity to witness his surgical abilities. His eyes were light-sensitive, he once told me, accounting for the dark-lensed aviator-style sunglasses he wore whenever he was in natural daylight. The sunglasses, a thin, dark cigar, and his Detonics 45 caliber pistols were his trademarks. These pistols, two of them worn in a double shoulder holster and sporting black rubber grips, were always with him. His abilities to save life with his surgical skills seemed at parity with his abilities to end life with his weapons and martial skills. John Rourke epitomized many things to me. Courage, tenacity, resolve. Over the years, my early impressions of him have only deepened to conviction. He was the finest and truest American I have ever met. May God rest his soul. Physical description of Rourke, John Thomas, ends.
Thank you, computer. Request satisfied.
Darkwood broke into a dead run, shouting over his shoulder to Aldridge and Stanhope.
I'm going to sick bay if you need me.
He ran into the companionway and at that intersection took a left. Maggie Barrow and her people would have taken the freight elevator. They'd be there by now. He took the vertical conveyor, swinging out of the shaft as it reached the upper level and running along the companionway towards sick bay. He entered the reception area. Office equipment was being pushed aside to make room for the incoming wounded.
Captain, can you give me a hand?
He nodded only, throwing his weight behind the desk, helping the nurse move it across the deck and against the bulkhead.
Thanks, sir.
Anytime, Helen.
Darkwood entered the surgery to find Margaret already at work. He hung back, scanning the room until he found what he sought. The man's Russian uniform and his weapons were piled in a corner. Darkwood went to the pile. The uniform was one of the newer ones, made with ballistic fabric. But soft body armor did little to protect against an assault rifle. He picked up the knife and drew it from the scabbard. The blade was easily a foot long, and marked on the left flat was Life Support System 10 with a circled R. It was a 20th century manufacturer's trademark symbol. There was the word crane, the circled R symbol again, and beneath it the stick figure of a bird. Ornithology had never been his passion, but he assumed the figure represented a crane. He flipped the knife over. On the right side blade flat, just beneath the massive double quillion guard, the steel was marked Prototype, and beneath that, 01. He sheathed the knife, making a mental note to get Louise Walensky to have one of her warfare people oil the knife and do something with the sheath. It looked to be actual leather and was sodden. Darkwood took up the double shoulder holster. It was leather as well. He looked at the actual holsters. They were marked Alessi. He assumed it to be a manufacturer's name. It took a long moment to deduce how to extract the guns from the holsters, but he did so one at a time, prying apart the snaps that closed the pistols into the holsters by securing through the respective trigger guards. The pistols were bright metal, presumably stainless steel or titanium, very much like the knife. The grips were black rubber, checkered, but much of the checkering worn smooth. With use, he presumed. A glance at the muzzles, he had knowledge of antique weapons, confirmed these were .45s. A chill shot up his spine. He did not attempt to disarm the weapons, handling them carefully instead. The guns were nearly twins. The one from the holster that would ride under the right arm was marked on the left slide flat Detonics 45, and in smaller print beneath it, Combat Master. The right slide flat bore no markings. The top line on the left slide flat of the second pistol was like the first, but the words Combat Master were engraved in script beneath it. He turned the gun over. On the right-hand slide flat beneath the ejection port, there was a facsimile signature engraved.
John Rourke.
Jason Darkwood set down the pistols. A descendant of the original man spoken of in Gunderson's memoirs? Or somehow...
Whoa.
As Darkwood stood up from his crouch in the corner, he heard one of the nurses assisting Maggie Barrow.
Dr. Barrow, did you see this? It's a vaccination mark, I think.
Come on, they haven't used vaccinations that leave a mark like that on the arm. Let me see that. Damn. It can't be a vaccination mark. Help me with this retractor.
Jason Darkwood looked back at the two guns there with the pile of blood-stained clothing.
Judas Priest.
Paul Rubinstein stood in the gathering darkness, watching as the last of the people from the cargo helicopters were herded into the camp. He, Otto Hammerschmidt, and about three dozen others from the contingent of Soviet troops under the command of the abrupt and, Paul had learned, heartless major, had been detailed to guard the interior of the fenced perimeter within which the meager tents were enclosed. The tents were now packed with naked prisoners. Paul doubted there was room in the tents for anyone even to sit, let alone lie down. Several times throughout the afternoon, Otto Hammerschmidt grabbed his arm and held him back when there were whippings, beatings, when mothers were forced to trudge naked through the snow, carrying their howling and dying infants. And Paul waited. Reason told him that to act rashly would be to act uselessly. The prisoners who were destined for extermination would not be served by his martyrdom. They would be served by intelligent action. Otto Hammerschmidt stood beside him, slapping his hands against his upper arms, stomping his feet against the cold. But for Paul Rubinstein, the unholy spectacle before him left the man numb to the elements. The massive concrete structures at the far end of the camp, that his gut reaction told him were crematoriums, were at the moment devoid of activity. But throughout the last hours of the afternoon, there had been considerable activity there. Piping was laid, and the segments of concrete were sealed against leaks. The temperature was dropping now with the sun, and he wondered how many of these people would survive to die the next morning. He had no intention of waiting that long to find out.
We have to arrange an escape for these people.
Paul Rubinstein looked at Otto Hammerschmidt oddly. A German and a Jew posing as Russians, guarding a death camp together.
What do you got in mind, Otto?
Paul looked back into the camp. The major was nowhere to be seen, and other than the pitiful sounds of humans reduced to the state of being cattle, there was only the growing howl of the wind.
We find the strongest among them and get them to help us. We arm them.
What are the rest of the guards be doing, Otto?
Damn. I suppose we must do it ourselves.
Paul Rubinstein looked toward the crematoriums because he heard engine noises. He closed his eyes against what he saw. He recognized the cylinders of gas coming near them on huge trucks. This was no modern variant of Zyklon B, but, however impossible to believe, something worse. These were the same type of canisters that carried the gas Vladimir Karamazov's forces used against the Soviet underground city. The gas that only affected males, corrupting their hormonal structure to turn men into bloodlusting creatures of destruction. He had seen it work. Seen men turn on their female comrades, even each other, killing until they themselves were killed or died of exhaustion from their murderous rampages. It was this gas that Karamazov was planning to use on his helpless prisoners. Perhaps as some test, perhaps only because he wanted to watch it. Sam Aldridge took a gulp from his coffee cup of medicinal whiskey that Jason Darkwood expropriated from sickbay.
Hey, go slow on that stuff, Sam.
Yeah.
Darkwood stood up and walked from the small sofa across the cabin to his desk, turned around to face Aldridge again, and leaned against the desktop as he spoke.
So, what happened?
Everything?
Well, tell me about this Rourke guy.
He made some joke about being 500 years old, God bless him. He risked his life for us like crazy. Then this.
Shit.
You said he was going back after a woman.
Aldridge nodded.
Must be some woman. Maybe one like him, wherever he's from.
You think he's telling the truth, Sam? I mean about being a 500-year-old American?
Sam Aldridge had been sipping at his whiskey. Now he swirled it in his coffee cup and set the cup down. Darkwood watched him intently.
Well, Sam?
Well, for starters, if John Rourke's 5 centuries old, I'd like to know his brand of whiskey. That man's good. He is so good, it would scare me to death if he was a bad guy, you know? He's like a machine. Deadly, efficient, but compassionate, too. I gotta say, if Rourke's an American, however old he is, he's the finest American I've ever met.
Darkwood was struck by his friend's words, almost the same words used 5 centuries ago by Commander Gunderson to describe the original John Rourke. Were they really one and the same? And where did he come from? The few old planes left in the Midwake fleet flew out in search of land-based life, and aside from some data concerning the Chinese, never anything conclusive, found nothing, no evidence.
Darkwood here.
Jason, this is Maggie. I've got to talk to you.
My place or yours?
Mine. I've got too many people down here to leave them for long.
Rourke, he's,
That's what I've got to talk to you about. How much longer until we dock at Midwake?
Darkwood consulted his watch.
A little over an hour. Will he make it that long?
Come down and talk to me about it. They're waving me over to another patient now, so take about 10 minutes, okay, Jace?
Right.
Darkwood stared at the comm box for a long time afterward. He gave her more than 10 minutes and still had to wait for her once he arrived in sickbay. Darkwood sat in Margaret's private office now, watching as she poured herself a glass of her own medicinal whiskey.
You want some?
Yeah, looks bad for the captain to drink on duty, but you go ahead.
Doesn't look too hot for the ship's medical officer either, but what the hell?
She took a long swallow from a coffee cup and set the cup down, then scrunched up onto the top of her desk and tucked her legs up.
So, is he gonna live?
I don't know. I think he's built like a rock, and he's been shot before, and that's evident from the scars. That's in his favor, because shock and trauma can be killers, too. Those new Soviet uniforms with the built-in soft armor took the spin out of those rifle bullets, so the bullets just penetrated and never exited. They didn't do as much internal organ damage as they could have. He lost a lot of blood. Some of the bullets just flat out, I can't get with these.
She raised her hands toward him, backs outward, fingers splayed.
Someone who specializes in delicate surgery and has the right team assisting? Yeah, maybe she could. I don't know. I mean, anybody could take him out and kill him. The head wound was just a deep graze, and the acid burns on his hand will heal quickly enough. Apparently that spray Sam mentioned was found in his shoulder bag? Well, it's some kind of combination antiseptic and accelerated healing agent, like our Dermiflex 2. Even smells similar. The arm wound isn't much, but the abdominal injuries? Shit. I lasered those bleeders, but I can't get half the bullets out. Couldn't even get near them.
Maggie, that's not what's bothering you.
No.
She took another sip from the coffee cup. Darkwood was beginning to feel out of place. Aldridge, now Margaret Barrow, everybody had a coffee cup except him.
Do you have your appendix?
Well, of course I don't. Nobody has an appendix anymore. It's just a useless organ working like a time bomb inside you.
The appendix has been removed from every infant born at Midwake in the last 4 centuries.
So? So he still has an appendix. Did you remove it?
No. I didn't think I had the right to. And as far as I could tell, there was nothing wrong with his anyway. My nurse found a vaccination mark.
Yeah, I was there.
But there hasn't been any such thing as a vaccination mark for centuries, Jace.
A vaccination mark and a healthy appendix don't make him 500 years old, either.
No, but he's not one of us, and he's not a Russian. I could tell their surgical procedures a deck away, and he's not Chinese.
Darkwood leaned back against the bulkhead.
Then he is a surface dweller from some other American community. Do you realize what that means?
He pushed away from the bulkhead and walked across to stand beside her. She rested her head against his chest.
It means we're not alone.
500 years old, or middle 30s, like the man looked to be. An American, not from Midwake, but from the surface of the Earth. Jason Darkwood touched his fingers to Maggie Barrow's hair, and she looked up at him, her green eyes tired, but pretty.
Hold me tight.
I was speaking with one of the Chinese, Jason. He was initially reluctant to speak, but warmed up after a bit. Apparently, the Chinese have quite a flourishing culture on the surface. They knew nothing of our mysterious friend Rourke, but did know that others may well exist on the surface as well. There are at least two Chinese cities, and possibly a third, though that is likely only rumor. The first city, as this Chinese calls his homeland, is most curious in its design. Rather like the petals of a flower. The various segments of the city, in fact, are called petals.
Sebastian, I'm interested in all of this, really. But right now, I'm more interested in our friend in sickbay.
Darkwood sat in his command chair, Sebastian hulking over him as he spoke. The familiar noises of the Reagan's Bridge, something Darkwood found himself oddly aware of, keenly aware of, as if a background for his thoughts.
This man Rourke, Sebastian, he is evidently from another culture like our own, but a surface culture.
I would be more inclined to think of it as a culture more similar to that of the Chinese. In many respects, more in touch with the reality of existence far beyond our own scope. For 5 centuries, Midwake has battled the Russians here beneath the sea. And for 5 centuries, both we and they have had precious little time for concerns other than survival. But, remarkably, on the surface, the Chinese enjoyed several centuries of peace. Now, we have advanced in the ways of war, but perhaps the Chinese and other terrestrial cultures there may have advanced in other ways. I have always found it ironic that our ancestors were scientists dedicated to advancing the possibilities of living and working beyond our planet, and we have been forced, in order to survive, to live, in effect, beneath it. Men and women of peace, forced to become a warrior culture.
We have art, learning. We do only what we have to do to survive, Sebastian.
At what cost, Jason? For generations, we have not seen the sun, except for rare visits to the surface within the past century by heroic people willing to attempt to fly outmoded aircraft in a so far vain search for others of our kind. A vain search until just a few short hours ago. And perhaps we have indeed found other Americans, potential allies and friends. But we may also lose them forever if this man Rourke dies, as it appears he might.
So your point?
My point is pointlessness. If we someday defeat our Soviet adversaries, what will we do then?
We'll return to the surface, I guess. It's habitable now. We've been sure of that for the last century, almost. But we can't return to the surface while the Russians remain a threat. They wouldn't dare use their nuclear missiles here in the ocean. It would be madness.
Then why have they developed them, Jason? In anticipation of destroying us after we have destroyed them? That is absurd. They intend surface conquest. The testimony of the Chinese with whom I spoke made it abundantly clear that his people have been plagued by our Soviet adversaries for some time. The ultimate goal may be conquest of the Chinese city on the surface, the technology they possess. Why go to the surface in order to struggle when you can go as a conqueror with a city and all that one might require already waiting for you?
That's an intriguing theory. And if the Russians were to do that, we couldn't stop them unless we fabricated nuclear weapons of our own, if we had the opportunity.
Yes. Build nuclear weapons. We threaten, and they threaten. And eventually they strike first, or we strike first, and the world is once again in ashes. What will we have achieved then?
The darkness was like velvet now, and the stars shone bright as they always did in the thinner atmosphere since the great conflagration. The temperature had dropped drastically. As Annie shifted her weight in the saddle, the blanket she cocooned around her upper body and draped over her legs began to slip, and she rearranged it. There was a shape, gray against the blackness, and she recognized it as one of the German field tents. Malin rode side saddle beside her, and for the first time in at least a mile, spoke.
I believe we approached the encampment.
Annie Rourke Rubinstein looked at the girl and nodded.
I believe you're correct. I know women did it for hundreds of years, but how can you ride like that? I'd be scared to death I'd slip off.
I will show you if you like.
Annie smiled at the thought, picturing herself in a long dress and fancy hat and veil, riding off to the hunt like something out of a videotape movie or a book.
All right. I'd like to try it, but I don't think I could ever get used to it.
Is it not uncomfortable riding astride as you do?
No, we get used to it. I haven't ridden in a long time. Very long time. But it just seems natural.
Annie turned her little horse. The Chinese horses seemed smaller in stature than Western horses. Up along a defile, the gray shape took more definite substance now. There was a flash of light where the tent flap should be, and for a brief instant she saw a figure profiled in the light. She kept riding, slowing her horse as the ground rose, then reining in a few yards away from the tent. Ma Lin and the Chinese soldiers stood a respectable distance behind her. At her left was Bjorn Rolvag, his dog Hrothgar over his saddle. Rolvag looked so ill at ease on horseback that perhaps, Annie thought, Ma Lin should teach the huge Icelandic policeman how to ride side saddle. The thought was amusing. Rolvag half fell from the saddle, his dog bounding away from him. Annie stayed where she was. The figure from the tent approached across the snow, a lantern in one hand, a pistol in the other. She could see his face clearly now as he belted the pistol and raised the lantern toward her. Annie learned from the chairman that his personal representative with the Rourke-Rubenstein party, sent to penetrate the Soviet base camp, was an intelligence agent named Han Lu Chen. He was a smallish man, wiry-looking and with an air of toughness, but with a warmth in his eyes that she liked.
So, you are Mrs. Rubenstein. It is an honor to meet a woman whose father, husband, and brother are all men of such great courage.
She had flown by J-7V, traveled by one of the German jeep vehicles, then rode the last 5 miles on horseback. She was tired of politeness.
Yes, and you are Han Lu Chen?
Yes.
Rolvag's dog was sniffing at Han's high boots, and the Chinese bent over to stroke the animal behind the ears. Then he reached up and took hold of the reins of her horse.
Your brother and your husband and Dr. Leuden have not been heard from in several hours. There is no reason to suppose that something is amiss, yet there is no reason for rejoicing. Please, join me in the tent for refreshment.
I came to look for my husband, my brother, and then for my father, Major Chemerovna. There's no sign of them either, is there?
There is no sign. It is cold out here. Please, may I help you dismount, Mrs. Rubenstein?
She only nodded, not that she needed help.
Oh.
She sloughed off the blanket, draped it across the front of the saddle, then rose in the stirrups, swung her right leg up and over, and stepped down. Han's hand at her elbow, she shivered without the blanket. The heavy shawl and the coat beneath it were usually more than adequate, but not now, after sitting for the past 5 miles with the cutting edge of the wind so terribly cold. Han led the way inside, and as he moved his lantern, she realized there were two other tents. The interior of Han's tent was just as she expected, warm, comfortable, and yet militarily austere. All at once, she was warm, and she took the shawl from her head and shoulders and folded it neatly, still standing just inside the hermetic seal.
I see that the rider who went on ahead of us has briefed you.
That you wish to rescue your husband and brother and Dr. Leuden, assuming they require it.
She opened her coat and swung back the coattails on both sides. The gesture worked for men. At her right hip was the Detonic Scoremaster 45, at her left hip, the Beretta 92F.
I assume they require it.
The Chinese looked at her for a moment, then smiled.
May I offer you refreshment, Mrs. Rubenstein?
I will feel more refreshed when I'm given information.
Very well, madame. The Russians are very strong here. Some while ago, helicopters were brought in. Very large machines, and my men were able to detect that people were being carried in aboard them. The people were young and old, male and female. They were children. All of them were naked. A force of Soviet soldiers herded them across the snow, I presume in some sort of short-term internment and perhaps eventual death. Much is going on in the Soviet base, but from the distance which prudence dictates, it is impossible to tell in great detail. It is clear that something must be done, and very quickly, Mrs. Rubenstein. But what? Without the data that would have been the natural result of the foray made by your husband, your brother, and Dr. Leuden, I am like a blind man, standing in the middle of a great hall with bottomless pits on all sides, into which I will easily fall if I take one false step.
You have a nice way with words, Mr. Han.
Annie stood her ground by the doorway.
But we have to do something. One thing I learned from my father was that it is better to move forward with prudence than to stand still.
Your father, he should have been Chinese.
It is my sincere hope you will be able to discuss that interesting observation with him at some future date. Get me as close to the Russian camp as we dare, and then we'll figure out what to do.
Very well, Mrs. Rubenstein.
Han bowed slightly to her.